Welcome to the Sober Betty Podcast, your boost of sober thinking and awesome life building. I'm Tara Zoe, CEO and co-founder here at Sober Betty, and I am joined by Ryan Phillips, ex-pro hockey player turned drug smuggler turned mental health advocate. I'm excited to get into Ryan's story, but first, remember to download and subscribe to the Sober Betty app, do some challenges, get some motivation, share screenshots of your sober tracker, and tell Betty how you're feeling today. Welcome to the show, Ryan. Let's dig in initially with your National Geographic episode that you filmed.
The National Geographic episode is called The King of Weed. I pioneered the marijuana industry in Canada. And with all the shipping down to the United States, that was me. It was way back in the mid-90s and whatnot. So I was still playing pro hockey at the time. And one pound led into two, led into 20, led into 100, led into 500, just huge business that was very lucrative at the time, illegal.
How does that make you feel that it's legal in California now?
I'm happy that people don't have to go to jail for it anymore. I did.
Does that make you feel like a little jaded that you went to jail for something that's now legal?
You know what? I have no regrets because it taught me a lot of valuable lessons along the way, and it humbled the you know what out of me going to prison for almost 2 years.
Yeah. Is that where you got sober?
I was sober in prison for 2 years. Absolutely.
Yeah, but yeah. Were you still sober when you got out, or did you go back to?
No, I got out and I went on a tear for for a few years. I was pretty angry at the world and pretty angry at the U.S. government.
Oh, because were you in a U.S. prison?
Yeah, it was actually a maximum federal penitentiary in Washington.
Okay.
And I didn't see the light of day for over 500 days. And, watched 9/11 go down while I was in prison. Thought we were in the middle of World War III, for crying out loud. And I was young at the time. So, it taught me a lot of mental resilience, that's for sure.
For sure.
But at the same time, it was basically like college for criminals. And, I never thought myself as a criminal. I was really just masterminding, trade routes.
You were a businessman.
I was a businessman, and I guess so they say, bit ahead of the curve by about 18 years before legalization in Canada. And, it is what it is. If you were smoking marijuana in the mid-90s up till about 2008 in the United States, 80% of the marijuana was being bought in BC from me and my group, so to speak. I was the leader of the crew. And so you're probably getting high on my supply. And hundreds of millions of dollars of business. And, that was portrayed on National Geographic show Locked Up Abroad. And, it was interesting to be on that show after crossing Canada for mental health. That's, I guess they saw what I was doing with giving back to society, which I really love to do. That's, my passion is just, being the best version of myself and really trying to give back to other people. And, obviously making my sobriety and not drinking, number one.
Right.
And then whatever else follows, just seems to follow, and just try to ride that momentum.
So how did you end up on National Geographic?
So what happened was in 2012,
okay,
I was in Southeast Asia and I was filming a movie on happiness.
Okay.
And I was in a little country called Laos, and it borders Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam. And I was skipping rope early in the morning, and I got a phone call from an actress friend of mine out of Los Angeles. Her name was Sarinda Swan. And she was working for an organization called the Somali Mam Foundation.
Okay.
And Somali Mam was a CNN hero for her help with eradication of child sex slavery and human trafficking. And she said, you're doing all this giving back, Ryan, this movie. Why don't we show the positive aspects of a bike ride that we're about to do across Cambodia, visiting five different shelters and these kids along the way. And even though it's a very dark business, why don't we shed some light on it and show, 21 riders, we're going across Cambodia to do this mission on, you know, raising money to build more shelters and raise more awareness, you know, to that cause, which is, right, you know, to me, absolutely despicable. Yeah. It needs, you know, you throw that right into the mental health ring. It's all, you know, one big soup, so to speak.
Yeah.
And my eyes were definitely opened.
For sure.
And it just so happened that that organization at the time was, you know, Barbara Walters was behind it, Queen Latifah, Ben Affleck, many celebrities, so to speak, and whatnot, people.
The people and, with the big P, you know.
Oh, God, you know, people. We're all equal at the end of the day, but some of us, you know, I guess get a little bit more recognition. And it just so happened that the Department of Homeland Security found out that Canada's biggest marijuana smuggler was now riding across the country to help kids. And the day after the ride across the country of Cambodia, I flew out to Chiang Mai, Thailand, and we were just going to keep filming. And there was really, you know, we plan on filming for about another month. But we had so much incredible footage, especially with that ride and the people that were just so wonderful. The children, just everything was just so beautiful. They got word that I went across the country for that purpose. Mm-hmm. And the next day, like I said, I'm in Chiang Mai. I get a phone call from my dad, and he goes, "Check your email." I checked my email, and it was a letter from the Department of Homeland Security that gave me the first of its kind humanitarian pardon back down to the United States for business and for pleasure. And that was, I was told after my incarceration that I would never be back down to the United States ever, ever again. Zero chance. Case done. You're done. You're never allowed back.
And,
within 5 days, receiving that pardon, I have a daughter that resides down in the U.S. and I played professional hockey down in the U.S. as well. Mm-hmm. I surprised her, knocked on the door, and it was a great way to finish the movie.
And did they put that in the movie?
Yes, they did.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's in the National Geographic movie, Locked Up Abroad, as well. So, that right there just really instilled in my being that, you know, being of divine service is definitely my definiteness of purpose. Mm. And, you know, no matter what, you know, we always got to obviously put ourselves first, but at the same time, you know, always thinking about others is really just the way I just try to live my life every day and every moment.
And I want to back up a little bit. Because I love where we're at here, and I want to back up, and I just want to say, okay, so you're a professional hockey player.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so when did things start to turn for you a little bit? I mean, you started to do, you know, professional hockey player turned drug smuggler, where you were doing hockey at the same time as the drug.
Absolutely.
Thing. Okay. So tell me a little bit about kind of where you were at with that, and how did that even come to be? Like, how did you decide I'm going to go smuggle marijuana into the U.S.?
Great question and easy answer.
Okay.
Okay. So my first year away from home, I was 16. Mm-hmm. And the hockey culture isn't all what we see on the outside. Sports culture, period. Mm-hmm. And being the youngest guy on a team of primarily 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, I had just turned 16. I humbly say I was, you know, probably well above most at my age, as far as I was ranked, you know, one of the top prospects in the world for my age at the time.
Right.
And, you know, I was told I made the team before I even went to training camp. And I had all these big dreams, you know, the big dream was to be the next best player in the world kind of thing.
For sure.
And, you know, I never had any issues with substance abuse or anything like that. You know, I was very, very, very extremely focused on the target of just achieving my goal of playing in the National Hockey League.
Right.
And then the rookie hazing started, the initiations, the drinking, just the whole culture that goes with hockey behind the scenes. And I wasn't good with that. And I was,
well, you were young, so young too.
I was young. I really, I didn't know how to really stand up to for myself at that time. And you're with this big, you just want to fit in.
Right.
And to fit in, I drank lots, and I took everything to the extreme. The coach, he looked at me as now a bit of an issue on the team, as kind of like a troublemaker, so to speak. But really, I was just trying to fit in, living in a new home,
Yeah,
a
that's a
new
lot.
town. And it was extremely difficult. I never voiced the pain that I was going through to my mom, to my dad. I didn't want to let myself down, my community, my parents, and everybody that had backed me to that point of my
Right.
journey. And after 5 years of junior and many injuries, concussions, broken bone, a lot of broken bones. I did turn professional at the age of 20,
Okay.
but during that time, I played 2 years down in Washington, and when I was in the States, I was 17, 18 years old. I was playing in Tacoma, Washington, and I'd have buddies of mine that would bring hydroponic marijuana down in deodorant sticks, and
Okay.
it was illegal down in Washington. You couldn't get what you could get in BC at the time. I know now marijuana is like far superseded
It has
its
grown up.
growth.
Yeah.
The United States grows the best marijuana in the world now compared to Canada. I mean, we grow good stuff here, but down there at the time, it was so frowned upon. And I mean, I didn't know that. I was so young and naive, and then you're blinded by the dollar.
Right.
And
And you're feeling invincible probably at that
oh
age.
yeah, you're feeling invincible, that nothing can touch you. You're not thinking of you're not thinking about too much other than in the moment. You're young, you're
Right.
dumb, and are actually young and smart and dumb in different
You're
ways.
just smart enough. It's like a dangerous smart.
Yeah, so what happened was I had all these connections down there in the States, and nobody else did in Canada. And the dollar obviously was much higher in the US, and the demand was absolutely massive. And my connections down there were able to take as much as I could send down there, and boats and trains and planes and bushwhacks and you name it,
And
I
how
found
did
a
you
way.
smuggle it? Like, what was it in?
Oh God, big trucks with compartments that could go through the X-ray machines with magnets, helicopters, planes,
So this was
water
like a
routes.
major operation. How old were you at this time when you're like organizing that kind of stuff?
I just turned 20 at
Wow,
that age.
this is
Yeah.
impressive. This is like an impressive enterprise moment, I
Well, I'll tell you what,
feel like.
for all the viewers out there, and for anyone that wants to know, we can, I have a private link to the National Geographic one that I can share. So
Yeah, we'll
I
put
can
it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes.
put it in the show notes, and then
Yeah.
if anybody asks, I can send me a private DM, and I'll send it to you on Instagram.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So you're 20, you have this massive enterprise going on of drug smuggling,
Yeah, marijuana
marijuana smuggling.
empire.
Your marijuana empire. Okay. And
That got extremely dangerous in the end.
right, what got dangerous about it?
Well, in the beginning, I'm Ryan, the hockey player, the skateboarder, the innocent kid that was just, part turned hockey player turned good time party guy. And I lost my focus with the injuries. I got bypassed in the draft. I did play professional. I didn't make the National Hockey League. I was very close, but due to certain circumstances, people moved ahead because of my injuries, and I was deemed injury prone. And I was mad at the game, and so I took on a different game.
Right.
And that game was it was never cocaine. I was never a coke dealer. I did lots of it, did barn loads of it along my journey. And it was definitely it was a learning experience. And I mean, I don't know what too much to say other than the fact that, I learned so much about people, because I never considered myself a gangster. I never considered myself someone that would be involved in organized crime.
Right.
But
And
the
that's what
bigger,
that is, and it's like you're not
absolutely.
thinking that.
but it just grew and grew. And next thing you know, it went from I'm sending 100 pounds down to Washington. And next thing I know, it's Portland. Next thing I know, it's Los Angeles. And Los Angeles was just, it was nuts. You know, I was doing about 500 pounds a week down to Los Angeles. And then the big market went into New York and Chicago. So then at one point I'm plugging Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and we're doing over 1,000 pounds a week. And it was just, it just got so insane. And I was the one who was running everything with the Blackberries that were all connected to servers in Costa Rica and whatnot. Mm. So we wouldn't be flagged by the feds, so to speak.
Interesting. And
so I took every precaution not to get caught, but to my demise, and a good thing that it did happen, because yeah, I was on a good tear for about 2 years where, I mean, the last year that before I went into prison, I think I probably drank every single day of that year. Mm-hmm. And I was doing, MDMA every night, the after hours, the just, partying like a rock star, living in mansions and buying properties and buying it just like it was the disease of more, really, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, all with just wanting to be accepted and to be loved and to be received as me.
And how are you feeling at that time?
Well, I mean, I did a lot of self introspection when I was in prison. I hung out with a lot of the older guys mm-hmm. in there that were, I was 23 and 24 years old when I was with those 2 years in prison. And I learned a lot just about tuning in to the law of vibration. I had one guy in there. He was a little Japanese guy. His nickname was Tojo. And he had 7 aliases, and he was in there for trafficking marijuana as well. Mm. And we got to be super close friends in there. And he introduced me to all his buddies, all these old timers and whatnot. And I'd been used to doing business with young guys my age. And he introduced me to all these guys in there, and they're like, why are you even sending weed down? He goes, we can just send money up. And I had all these options. So when I got out of jail, I actually relapsed the first night that I got out.
Which kind of makes sense, that you have that freedom feeling. And
it was like Shawshank Redemption that night. It was pouring rain. Mm-hmm. I got to the border, and I was in a bulletproof van. They took off the shackles and the chains, and I literally put my hands up. I was like, freedom! Mm-hmm. And I didn't even tell my parents that I got home that night. And I went, first thing I did, went over to one of my old bro's place that was involved. And the business had been suffering since I went to prison because all the connections were basically mine.
Right.
And now I have like 20, 30 more connections.
Right.
And, old dogs sometimes you can't teach them new tricks.
So you got out and you continued to do it?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Okay.
I did. I got out, and within 2 or 3 days I was back in business, and within 2 or 3 months I was a millionaire again. Mm. And I just, I felt this really empty feeling, but at the same time, a lot of power, because you got all this money to do whatever you want.
Right.
And all I ever really wanted to do, with my life, as far as like bringing in, say, currency, was to have freedom to do whatever I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do it.
Right, I feel that. And,
mm-hmm. The National Hockey League, I was making more money than anyone playing hockey at the time. I was, mm-hmm. On a good week, I'd make $500,000.
Right, right.
And I'll let this be known right now. I have zero, zilch, none of that money. It's all gone.
It's all gone.
The properties. I was never supposed to have that money. They were just, they were lessons learned. Mm-hmm. And all those people that I was involved with at that time, many are dead, in jail, addiction issues and whatnot. And I don't talk to any of them. I see some of them on the street once in a while, and there'll be a quick hello maybe or not. Maybe a little bit of resentment on their side, because right. I narrowly escaped my life. Right. If you ever do get a chance to watch the National Geographic,
we're gonna watch it. We're doing this.
Yeah, guns to my head. It shows it on there, but it happened a few times, and having friends that were murdered and whatnot was just, when's it gonna happen to me? You know, I'm not just Ryan the hockey player anymore. Now I'm being looked at as a gangster. Now I'm being looked at as, you know, someone who's highly involved in organized crime, because I was at the top of the food chain. And I didn't even realize it. I was blinded by the veils of illusion, so to speak.
Okay.
And there was suitcases coming in, suitcases and hockey bags, duffel bags full of money. I'm having to get my dad to bury money in the backyard and whatnot. And, you know, I had to rent houses to, you know, put safes in, because I didn't have any room to put money. That was my biggest problem, was finding places to put money. And that's probably why I gave away so much. But what it did give me an opportunity to do was to travel the world. And, you know, I've been to over 70 countries in my life now.
Nice.
Southeast Asia, I've been over there. It's got a huge place in my heart. I've been over there 37 times and traversed over, it's been 8 countries now that I've gone across for a purpose.
Nice.
Three countries I've gone across for the purpose of human trafficking and child sex slavery. And I was able to do a TED Talks on that as well. And 5 for mental health awareness.
I love that. I love it. So so you went back into it. So what was the moment that you said that, like, things changed and you got sober and you made this shift in your life, because now you're a mental health advocate?
Yeah.
You know, you're not a gangster drug smuggler anymore. Like, no, there's a gap it. There.
You know, it's funny. Dan Carradine's a friend of mine. I was just in New York and we did a live podcast at his studio, and he asked me the question, what was that moment, you know, that defining moment where it was just enough was enough. And I think what happened, and I hope this isn't too graphic, but this is the reality, is that, you know, a friend of mine who was working for me at one point for quite a few years, he fell off my train and went into the cocaine business.
Okay.
And he was over in Mexico making a lot of money, doing stupid things that, you know, are very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And he got shot 14 times and lost his life. And an innocent friend went to visit him, not knowing what he was getting into, heard the gunshots. Walked outside the condo doorway and took 5 bullets to the head. And just hearing that and knowing that that was going on, it was just like, you know,
like a wake up call.
Wake up call, but my time could be coming, because of I was on the map now. People knew how much money that was coming in. You know, when you're putting out that much money. I mean, I wasn't doing the work, but I was behind the scenes.
Right.
And, you know, I wasn't exactly, I was, you know, driving fancy cars.
Yeah. You weren't being discreet.
I wasn't being discreet. And I think the only reason I was being left alone is because I wasn't dealing coke and the hard drugs, you know, heroin and whatever else. You know, it was very accepted, so to speak. And I never hurt anybody. So I think that was one of the reasons I was being left alone, until it did happen, where very close calls, you know, had to take a lie detector. I got accused of stealing $2 million worth of cocaine down in Los Angeles, where I wouldn't even know where to get my hands on that.
Right.
And it was just one of those things where I was living in a home. I had mirrored ceilings on the roof of my room, and I was all alone in this big mansion that I had this massive party. About 400 people were there the night before, and you know, DJ in the sunken living room, the whole 9 yards. Fun. I think it went on for a couple days, but, you know, fun but not fun.
Right.
And, you know, like, everyone just come over so I can have more attention.
Right.
And I remember
it's very self-aware.
Very self-aware, that's for sure. And, you know, I don't know how much coke and MDMA, ecstasy, whatever you want to call it these days.
Yeah. But,
I did that night, and I got a little bit of sleep, but I remember waking up and my emotions were so off the charts in such a negative way of, like, what am I doing to myself? And I looked at myself in the mirror. I had no choice. I mean,
there were mirrors all over. Yeah.
I had mirrors all over. And I went, I looked at myself and I just broke down. And I went into my, into the shower. I was on my knees and I literally, I bawled my eyes out for probably close to an hour, I would say. And I was, that was it. That was the defining moment where I was like, there's absolutely no way I can do this anymore. And, you know, that put into motion me having to call a meeting with my crew, the muscle, so to speak.
Yeah.
And
you're straight up gangster. You had like your muscle.
Straight up gangster. Yeah, I had muscle, all right. And they said to me at the time, they said, you know, well, for now, you're with us no matter what. And if we find out that you do it again, if you're doing any runs without us, we'll kill you.
For sure.
And that scared the you-know-what out of me. And I packed up. Got out of Vancouver for quite some time. I did a lot of traveling and I was scared to come back and just to be around an environment that I'd tread really, really light, shallow waters. And, you know, especially getting out of prison and doing it again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I own it. I'm not perfect. You know, it was the easiest hard money that you could ever even imagine to make. And then you take it for granted where even though it's illegal, it's like, you're winning the lottery every couple of days. As soon as a load of marijuana is landing down the States and you're making well over $1,000, sometimes $2,000 per pound, you know, times that by 500 pounds, 600 pounds to do the math, there's a lot of money there. And I guess probably what kept me alive too is I shared so much of it with the people that I was around. And, you know, fun to like, it was no fun and very scary.
And
my parents, I was having nightmares that I died and I got murdered in my dreams and someone had to come to my parent. My parents are so straight laced. It's ridiculous. They're amazing. And I've always been so supportive. And them, you know, getting a knock on the door from the cops saying that, you know, your son has been killed or something like that. And just the thought of that, of how, you know, what I would do to my folks and my family. That was it. And yeah.
And then so, when you did that, when you went to travel, did you get sober as well? Or was that a separate thing? Okay.
I actually got sober when I've been in recovery for 17 years. I've relapsed a few times. Mm-hmm. I'm now at 6.5 years sober, July 8th of this past year.
Congratulations.
I took 6 years and, you know, I've a few slips along the way, but I will say that in the last, this time around, 6.5 years, I have had not even the slightest urge to have a sip of alcohol. And it doesn't mean I don't have my bad days. It doesn't, you know, we all have good days and bad days, but I mean, or no bad days, just learning days. And some days are just filled with more emotions than others and challenges.
For sure. Yeah. You never, if you're a human, you're going to have, you know, struggle points. You're going to
And that's the thing. So many people think that, I'm going to get sober and all my issues and problems are going to be solved. But it doesn't work that way.
What do you think the difference is? Like, how would you compare it?
Well, I think that, you know, it's definitely a thinking disease and it really, you're able to reframe your thinking and really you get to be honest with yourself. And yeah. I know that, you know, when I really dived in deep into the program, it saved my life on so many ways. You know, my first sponsor actually committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here was a guy who was almost 7 years sober at the time. His nickname was Miracle. I'm not going to say his last name. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, we're all miracles if we're sober and we've been down the depths of the dark side, so to speak. You know, that was an eye opener and just to see that, you know, even though you got one day, 30 days, half a month, 20 years, it doesn't matter. You really got to keep working it. And it's such an inside job and how you do it is, you know, is definitely up to you, but there's a guidepost And if we follow that guidepost, it's so pivotal that, you know, it's faith without deeds is dead. You know, we got to have that faith.
I think working out is a good example of this. It makes you emotionally stronger.
Yes.
Making yourself physically stronger makes you, like, there's something that shifts in your brain about your abilities and your inner, like, emotional strength, even though you're working your muscles. And that's just like when you take an action, you're building this self believability, you know, and, mm-hmm. and teaching yourself that you can do these things and that they're real.
Oh, 100%. I just got back from New York and I've been slipping on my workouts, and I'm huge into fitness. And if I don't get into the gym, you know, at least 5-6 days a week, you know, to get that dopamine going into my brain. I need it. I've suffered a lot of concussions due to hockey and other things that happened outside of hockey. And if I'm not, you know, being very, you know, conscious about my physical health and my mental health, then it's, you know, there's a decline, and you know, I get that restless, irritable, discontent feeling. And that's a feeling, as you know, being in, you know, for me, a recovered alcoholic, is not a good feeling at all. It's yucky and muddy. I don't like those waters.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, during COVID, when it was just like everything was just so disrupting, I would walk for hours. I just had to move.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, I got to be out of my like space and like walk. And that was the only thing we were allowed to do, you know, was 100%. Walk. You're not allowed to stand still. You have to walk.
I am so, like, I'm a total introverted extrovert. You know, I can speak in front of 10,000 people doing a TED Talks on I've done two TED Talks. I did one on, you know, ending the evil epidemic of child sex slavery, and I've done one on mental health.
I saw your one on mental health. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I was misdiagnosed with bipolar, later to find out that it was concussion related.
Interesting. And,
Yeah. Very interesting. So,
and then how do they heal that? Do they, is there something they can do for that?
Well, I see one of the top neuro guys here in Canada, and we do a lot of, you know, electricity treatment and whatnot. So a lot of it is really a mindset for the individual, just like trauma is individualized.
Right.
So, you know, the trauma that I've taken to my brain, it really kicked in during the pandemic. You know, I was able to avoid a lot of that because of action, you know, being able to, you know, especially, you know, when I was riding across Canada, it's a huge country. I did it in I did it in 2 months. I was doing about 120 kilometers a day.
Good for you.
I'm not a cyclist. So that's the thing.
By the end you were like, I'm a cyclist.
Yeah. After losing 30 pounds, God, when I took a shower, I was afraid I was going to fall down the drain.
Oh my gosh.
But it was taxing on the physical and the mental and the spiritual, for sure. You know, during that time, I met so many incredible people on the journey.
That's awesome.
I have to say the two top bike rides for a purpose that I've done in my life was the one in Cambodia, the first one that I could see how much awareness could come through action. And then obviously the one across Canada. That, you know, every day I woke up, it was just such a blessing, to know that you're not alone.
Yeah.
And the only thing I would do differently now is bring more people along for the ride with me.
Yeah.
And that's a lot kind of what plays into, you know, what I'm doing right now with hosting this TV show, True Redemption. I was going to go across Canada again and do another documentary. But we thought it would be a lot better if we get more people involved that have, you know, been in the mental health arena, so to speak. You know, guys like, you know, Dan, who's he's I think a year and a half sober now, wonderful guy, and you know, a lot of people that are very recognizable in the world, and showcase them through my own experience.
Right.
And because to me, it's a we thing. It's not a me thing. And, you know, I think a lot of that ride across Canada was trying to prove to myself and my psychiatrist that he's wrong. I was like, okay, you're going to call me bipolar and I shouldn't do this and I shouldn't do that. And, you know, at the end, he was on my side, but there was a lot of people saying, you know, you can't do this. There's no way. You can't go across the second largest landmass in the world in 2 months. Not a chance.
Right.
And I was like, well, you know, whatever the mind can conceive and believe, the mind can achieve. And that's a quote from Napoleon Hill from Think and Grow Rich, but I'll take it. So, but it was incredible, you know, just, you know, to meet people along the way that share the same, you know, we're all the same, but different. At the end of the
right.
day.
Right. There is that connectedness. And that's why story is so powerful. And that's why it's 100%. When we talk about our experiences and you're talking about the togetherness, I think that's so key in that is that when we're in this togetherness, we kind of see like, oh, you know, I'm not alone. And yes. that concept by itself is incredibly healing.
And that's what it's all about. And, you know, this is this show stands for the collective healing. That's that. It's all about healing. Back in the day when I was in the illegal game, I lost a lot of friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I've lost a lot of people from the hockey community, outside the hockey community, people that reach out. I mean, I would say in the last 6 months, I've probably lost over a dozen people that Jeez. Not all of them were super close to me, but they were, you know, close enough where it hit me on a very heart level.
Yeah,
have taken their own lives, and you know the collateral damage to that. With you know they're gone. You know they've transitioned into the non-physical, but now, but the families, it's so crushing. It's soul crushing is really what it is. So
yeah.
Many of us that have gone through the gamut of addiction and mental health are facing the dark night of the soul. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of demons that we have to face sometimes. And if you don't face them, then we don't heal.
Right.
Not always easy.
And I just want to say here that sometimes you do need help with that.
Oh, so yeah. I do psychotherapy. I got to say.
Yeah. So if you are feeling like it's not something that you can face on your own, that is okay. There are people who can help you get through it. And there are so many techniques that can make that experience not as scary. This idea that we think of bad emotions and good emotions.
Yeah.
And we think like it's not okay to have the bad emotions. And really, the thing that's hurting us is the stuck emotions, whether they're positive or negative. We just tend to stick negative emotions more because we don't want to deal with them than positive. And just saying like, when you work through those, even though they feel like this thing that you can't face, when you unstick it and it flows and it can kind of flow out, then there's just a massive amount of relief.
Massive. Absolutely. Yeah. It's like taking the path of least resistance. So yeah, no, it's very interesting what's going on these days. And you know, I'd like to think it's getting a little bit better. Mm-hmm. You know, just being back here in Vancouver after New York, the contrast is, mm-hmm. you know, on both sides of the border, a little different. You know, here in Canada, it's, you know, where I reside here in Vancouver, it's the crisis mainly is the fentanyl. You know, the drinking leads into one thing. And then the next thing you know, it's, you know, someone's doing, you know, picks up a bag of Coke and everything. It seems like
it's in everything.
It's in everything these days. Yeah. So you just got to be so careful, you know, and here's the king of weed, so to speak, on National Geographic. And, you know, my main message now is just don't do it. Just, please.
It's not. You know? Yeah. It's so much more risky. I mean, there's kids dying all the time because their first time they use a pill, you know, it ends up being a fake pill that has fentanyl in it. And
well, I heard about those two girls out in Hollywood there about, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. They thought they were doing ecstasy and they were both fentanyl pills and, you know, broke my heart, 15 years old, you know, just at the, you know, right to start their life off. And, you know, they think that name ecstasy, it sounds good. So you think that it's not going to be bad, but
well,
you
yeah. And they're thinking, yeah, there's just so much, guys. Like We've had, I don't know if it's LA or Orange County, you had 9 kids or something like that die in like the first couple weeks of school from a fentanyl overdose. So now they're distributing Narcan to all the teachers, everybody. And it's just like, I carry Narcan in my purse. It's just, you know, it's like, we just are in a crisis. It's a horrible, horrible crisis. And it's, while it's like in the news, all the time, right? Like every week, I just feel like, it almost feels like we're not talking about it. Yeah, even though we're talking about it, we're not talking about it.
And we got to talk about it more. That's the thing. It's imperative to everybody's. I believe we're all connected at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And this phone, sometimes, you know, we all carry these smart gadgets in our pocket that we're staring at and looking at and scrolling and comparing a lot these days. You know, sometimes it weighs 5,000 pounds just to call somebody for help. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the big thing. It's like, okay, reach out for help. There's this hotline, that hotline, but it's actually doing it, you know, picking up that phone.
That's the hard part. That's why I love that you can text now too, because for some reason, texting feels a little less scary, you know, but that's what we're talking about is like the emotional risk factors. You know, how many emotional points is this going to cost me to do that? Yeah. That was one of the big reasons we did the Sober Buddy app, is we were thinking, okay, if people feel like they can do it like secretly, or they don't have to commit, they can just like dabble in it.
Yep.
Then that will be less emotional risk. And so that's an introduction and an entry point, you know, and that has worked. And so that's been a big thing, is like, you don't even have to be sober. Just go on there and test it out.
Cause you just nailed it right on the head right there. Is that it can actually apply to everybody, anybody and everybody.
Yeah. And you can observe for some time, you know, like you can spend time observing the idea of sobriety, the idea of recovery before you take that big step, you know, or whatever, or maybe you just kind of like slowly trickle into it.
100%. Yeah, we all need less scary these days. There's enough fear rippling over the masses.
Yes, yes. And so that's a big thing, is like there are so, and I want to just say this because there's so many scary things happening, but there's also so many beautiful things happening. Yeah. And people are recovering and people are getting sober like crazy. So many people are getting sober right now. And that is huge. And there's so much support available now for sobriety, like in all different forms. I mean, there's sober social media, there's sober podcasts, there's sober apps, there's all different kinds of Zoom groups, you know, everyone's starting.
It's there. If you desire to have it, it's there for you.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, especially over the last year, the division is not so, it's not like it was, you know, the first, you know, year and a half or so, whatever it was. I think we're almost 3 years into this. Well, I think Biden just called the pandemic is officially over.
3 years into this nightmare that we've been dealing with.
Oh God. I was at a film festival when COVID hit and they had to shut down the film festival. And it was in Idlewild, California.
Okay. I know where that is.
You know where it is? Yeah. Beautiful town. It up is top beautiful. Up near San Bernardino. Absolutely gorgeous. And I remember we were halfway through the film festival and all of a sudden we hear about this coronavirus and, you know, just like anything else. I remember when, SARS was 2006, I think it was.
Yeah, SARS. And we were so removed from that though, you know?
Yeah. And I think it was like maybe 2 or 3 months you heard about it and people had the masks over there in Asia and whatnot. I actually was over in Southeast Asia when it happened. And so I came back. But this, you know, to happen globally has been the most riveting, shocking thing. That, I mean, I think everybody's got a story when it comes down to their COVID experience. I mean,
you know,
I don't
it
know
feels
if
very much like a war, you know, like where it changed everything.
Yep.
You know, so this has been definitely a collective experience. But what I want to say for this was such a big movement forward for mental health. And, and because people have been suffering quietly from mental health issues since before COVID. When we all suffered from the same thing at the same time, It suddenly was okay to say, I'm suffering. And that started a conversation. Yeah.
How many people, and I would say, you know, especially men, have now opened up and are so much more vulnerable now.
Yeah.
Actually, like, really, really, like, you don't have to have this tough guy persona, you know, like.
Or you can value your family. Like, that's come in a lot, too, because we were all home with our families and our dogs and everything that happened. It's like, I feel like it took us from this expectation of, like, roboticness and even in the workplace or whatever to, like, you're not a person, to saying, no, we're all people. We all got families. We all got issues.
Oh, God. Yeah. I think the stores need to load up on a lot of tissues. Even still, God, I find myself even, you know, I'll be driving down the street and I just feel like bawling my eyes out sometimes.
Like it released and something. Yeah.
It's just, you know, because a lot of us, you know, we pick up on other people's energy. We absorb other people's energy, especially when we're out there in the field. So
yeah, I was saying, you're exposing yourself to a lot of things by being in the mental health field, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I find that I'm starting to kind of pull back a little bit because, you know, I got to prioritize myself.
Yeah, you got to protect yourself. Number one. Yeah. Just if someone's going through it right now and they're really struggling and they're, let's just make it specific to drugs and alcohol, because that's kind of what people listening to the podcast are going to be focused on, is what would be a thing that you would say to them?
Well, number one, you know, when you know, when, if you're going down the rabbit hole, and that hole is not a nice hole to be in. And get trapped in and maybe have the possibility of losing your life. And you are so bloody worth it. And you're so full of love and you're so full of potential. So I think at the end of the day, and in that moment of despair, is that there's meetings all over the place, all over the world. You know, there's AA hotlines, there's all kinds of different, you know, ways that we can actually get help. But I think number one is really you need to make that decision that your life is become unmanageable. And it's all about you deserving a good life and not letting addiction get the best of you, because that's what happens. The addiction becomes much more stronger than the actual willingness to have a good life. And I know that from experience, even with my own daughter. My own daughter was addicted to crystal meth for 4 years. And she's now 2 years sober. And, you know, I'm so proud of her, but she was one of those ones that just barely made it by the skin of her teeth. And, you know, she was on the street for the last 2 years. She had a child and she died while she was in labor. She was put on life support for 2 days. You know, she has worked, she put the work in. And now she, like I said, she's coming up on 2 years sober. If she can do it, if I can do it.
You're not lost. You're not past hope.
You're not, if you're alive and you're still breathing, I believe that you're here for a purpose. And what that purpose is, more will be revealed.
You know what? I want to say this. I love that you said you're full of love. That just, because when you're in a dark place, you do not feel that way.
No,
you feel like you're full of acid, you know, like just burning. And to feel like maybe I'm full of love. I love that. And if you're out there and you feel like you're ready to take some steps and get help, or you're trying to do it on your own and you need more help, remember that you can get the Sober Buddy app, and that will give you step-by-step challenges to teach you how to get and stay sober. So go get the app, do your Sober Buddy challenges, and take your life to that next level and set yourself free. Well, I just want to really thank you, Ryan, for coming on today. And do you have any last words?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on, and for anybody out there, I'm sending you massive love, all the hope, all the courage. You got this.